Well, please tune in to another episode of Hashtag Sisters in Law. We had a great conversation this week.
Yes, we talked about a lot that's coming up, including the New York trial of Donald Trump and what's coming up in the Supreme Court. But also, we talked about how excited we are to be nominated for a Webby's Award.
And how excited we are to be together with each other and with you, our listeners, at our live shows, May 2nd, 9th, and 30th. We hope to see you there, and we hope that you will take the time to vote for us as the best podcast for news and politics on the Webbies. It's the Oscars for us podcasters, and we really want to win. We're very competitive, so please vote for us and get your friends to do the same.
Hi, this is Jen Rubin, and this is Jen Rubin's Green Room. So we're at the beginning of a historic week because Donald J. Trump is facing a criminal case. He is finally in court. There's a judge. As we record this, they're in the midst of selecting a jury, and he will have to sit there day after day after day and listen to people testify against him. He may not like that. In fact, there's a very good chance he's going to blow up. And we'll see how that affects the jury if he does it when they're present. And we'll see how it affects the judge. And there was already a motion to hold him in contempt because, of course, he has violated the judge's gag order. That order is pretty simple. You're not supposed to threaten the people who are going to be witnesses. But no sooner was the ink dried on the original order and then the clarification of the order than Donald Trump took to social media and started attacking Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels, two people who are certainly witnesses in this case. And now the question is, what is Judge Merchan going to do about it? Well, we'll find out for certain, but I think this is the first real test of how differently are we going to treat Donald Trump simply because he is a former president. And I say simply because that should not be the defining factor here. He doesn't get a different set of rules simply because he used to be president. That defies the entire purpose of this exercise, which is to show that the rule of law applies to everyone. People who are president, people who were president, people who want to be president again, it doesn't matter. The same rules, whether it's the substantive criminal law or whether it's the rules of behavior when you're in court and on trial, have to apply to everyone, or it really means nothing. Now, a lot of people have said, well, this is sort of a picayune little case, isn't it? Au contraire. This is the first case in which Donald Trump successfully lied, pulled the wool over the eyes of the voters, and got himself into power. And it convinced him, I am absolutely certain, that he was beyond any law, beyond truth-telling, beyond any constraint. In 2016, he was lying and covering up sex scandals. In 2020, of course, he was lying about the election results. Now he's lying about both and trying to get back into office. But this case really begins, it's sort of an inception story. If not for the lies about Stormy Daniels and about his other affairs, if not for the effort to cover it up so that the public would not be aware of yet another sex scandal, this in the wake of Access Hollywood, he might never have been president. We might never have had the Supreme Court we do. We might never have had January 6th, and on and on and on. So talk about the vagaries of history and small events leading to very, very big results. So we'll find out. I tend to have more faith in the average person, the average juror, than many. I think it's very, very hard to get on a jury when you have an agenda. And we've already seen scores of people say, I cannot be impartial. So they're honest enough to acknowledge that. And believe it or not, we're going to come up with a impartial jury. We always do it, no matter how infamous the defendant, no matter how infamous the crime. We are able to do it. That's the American justice system, and I will have faith in it. So that's a positive. Meanwhile, Congress is still diddling over the aid to Ukraine and the aid to Israel. We'll see if they can figure it out in the next few days. It's a disgrace. We have let the Ukrainians down. We have allowed them to be on the defensive. The Russians have bombed cities, have recaptured territory, have certainly killed more Ukrainians than would otherwise be the case had Congress been responsible. And that is on the shoulders of Donald Trump and Mike Johnson, who are poodles of Putin. They are entirely beholden to a dictator who wants to undermine democracy, who is the prime antagonist of our European allies. And there's no getting around that. They are disloyal to American interests, and they are willing to sacrifice the lives of other people, of the Ukrainians. So we'll see if they can kind of get their act together this week. Meanwhile, as Donald Trump is sitting in the courtroom, President Biden is campaigning all over Pennsylvania. And don't you think this was exactly what he intended? As Donald Trump has to sit there, the president is making stop after stop in one of the most critical swing states, Pennsylvania. He always likes going back to Scranton. That's where his roots are. And you've heard Joe from Scranton however many times, but he's going to be out there. And I will say this, if you've noticed how active the president is, he's campaigning. He's on the road day after day after day, multiple events in a day. Do you ever see Donald Trump do that? I don't think so. No, you don't. And in fact, he fell asleep in the courtroom. Sleepy Don. Yep. That's Donald Trump for you. So it's all projection. Just remember that. So I think we're going to have an eventful few weeks. In the meantime, I just want you to keep in mind the split screen. We have Donald Trump harumphing, grousing, muttering in court, maybe snoozing off some more. And on the other side, we have President Biden, who is out campaigning, who is doing the country's business, who is trying to resolve international crises. And that's quite the contrast, isn't it? And that's really what the election is about. Do we want someone who is absorbed with himself and his own criminality? Or do we want someone who actually cares about the American people and thinks it's his responsibility to solve problems? I don't see how there's any choice whatsoever, any possible confusion between who is a fit president and who's not. But that's just me. As many of you know, I'm an inveterate reader. And when I read something that is so fascinating and grips me so deeply, I feel compelled to tell you and my readers at the Washington Post all about it. And there are very few books that had me as intrigued as a recent release, the name of which is Fluke, F-L-U-K-E, by Brian Klass. And it's a book after my own heart, because the premise, as we're going to hear from Brian, is that the world is not as predictable, not as plannable, not as rationally understandable as we may think. That it's the small, completely unpredictable, coincidental, irrational moments and factors that play a much bigger part in our lives. And Brian's thesis is that once we understand that, it's actually more empowering and not less empowering. That all sounds very intriguing. You get an idea of why the book grabbed me so. So without any further ado, Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And congratulations on your new British citizenship. I read all about your very difficult test. So you passed and you're in.
I'm in and I can vote.
Isn't that exciting? Wow. Now, can you still vote in American elections as well?
Indeed, I'm a super citizen now. I get to vote in probably in two of the most important elections in the world this year.
That's fabulous. Well, I must say the only party that's in worse shape than the American Republican Party might be the British Conservative Party. It is, I think, appropriate that they had the lettuce head lady over at CPAC in the United States, because there is a certain commonality between Liz Truss and the fate of the Republican Party. But we'll leave that for another time. You have written a book, Fluke, which is very hard to encapsulate, but I'll give a stab at it and you'll tell me if I sort of get it right. And that is, we consistently underappreciate the degree of randomness, luck, chance that influences events. And as a result, we make lots of mistakes along the way. Is that kind of the beginning of the nub of it?
Yeah, that's a very good encapsulation. It's basically applying chaos theory to humans and arguing that the world is far less controllable, far less predictable, and far more random than we are often told it is.
How did you decide to write on this topic? Was there something that happened in your life or in your studies of history that you thought, you know, we've all been looking at history wrong. We should really be looking at these small little weirdo events that change the course of history.
Yeah, it's both really. So, I mean, there's a series of things that have happened to me in my professional life as a social scientist where I'm trying to cram the messiness of the world into models, right? That sort of makes sense with five or six variables. And I've interviewed coup plotters around the world who have said that they want to do exact revenge because, you know, the president had flirted with their wife or, you know, something so banal and personality based. And then you get to the numbers and you're supposed to encapsulate all this with GDP per capita, right? Like this as an explanation. So part of it is that I think social science is trying to smooth out the noise of life in ways that actually mislead us. Even though I am a social scientist and I believe in the discipline, I think we've gone too far in that direction. And the other aspect is, as I sort of recount in the first chapter of Fluke, I'm the byproduct of a mass murder. So there was a woman named Clara Madeline Jansen who unfortunately killed her four children in 1905 in Wisconsin, and she was my great-grandfather's first wife. And so I wouldn't exist if those kids didn't die. And if that doesn't give you an appreciation for the chaos and complexity of life, nothing will. So, you know, in quite a literal way, our conversation is a byproduct of that mass murder, as everything in my life has been. So I think it's sort of the personal and the political combined to sort of tug at me and make me say, look, everything's a lot more complex than we often imagine it is.
You begin also with a story about the dropping of the nuclear bomb and how it was that one city was hit and not another. Tell our audience what that was.
Yeah, so the story begins in 1926 with an American couple who goes on vacation to Kyoto, Japan. And 19 years later, the husband in the couple is Henry Stimson is his name, and he becomes America's Secretary of War. And the Target Committee, which is basically a group of generals and scientists and so on, decides that Kyoto is their top pick for the first atomic bomb to be dropped. It's got propaganda value, it's a big city, it's producing airplanes, etc. And so Stimson is horrified by this because he's got a soft spot for his vacation hub. And so he twice meets with President Truman and gets Kyoto taken off the list, and the first bomb goes to Hiroshima instead. And the second bomb is supposed to go to a place called Kokura, which many people haven't heard of. But it was cloud cover briefly that diverted it and the bombers to Nagasaki. So, I mean, it's a quite literal truism that the first bomb went to Hiroshima because of a 19-year-old vacation, and the second bomb went to Nagasaki because of a cloud. And, you know, following up on the point I just made about modeling, is if you were trying to put variables together to explain atomic bomb locations, vacation history and clouds would not be on your list. And yet they swayed the direction of history in quite profound ways.
And of course, had we not had a zillion conversations and events before that, had Einstein not written to FDR, had they not found the perfect person to run the Manhattan Project, had all of these events not happened, we wouldn't have gotten to that point, and perhaps we would have had a mass slaughter in the invasion of Japan, and all of nuclear history would be very, very different. So I think we sometimes get confused when we say, well, there are big factors at work here. And there are, but there are also small little factors that make a difference. And I am a big Civil War fan, so I was very intrigued by your analysis. Historians, amateur historians, like to put a whole lot of emphasis on Gettysburg. It was a big battle, there was a movie made about it, very dramatic, on and on. And you say, yeah, regardless of how that comes out, we should take it back a little bit and look and see at an event that actually happened at Antietam. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I mean, you're right. The world sort of is between chaos and order. And there are big forces, but there's also small details. And sometimes they're found, as I say in the book, lurking in the weeds, quite literally. Now, this is the story of a man who is sitting by a fence row, sort of, you know, in the hedges, taking a break from marching in the Union Army in 1862. And he sees this thing that catches his eye, and he picks it up, and it turns out to be three cigars that have been wrapped in this paper. And they turn out to be the marching orders for the Confederate Army that had fallen off of a messenger's horse, basically. And they had this sort of, you know, the marching orders of where the Confederate Army was about to go. So the Union Army is sort of, you know, very excited at the possibility that they might have figured out exactly what the next move for Robert E. Lee is going to be. And yet they don't know if it's actually the right move. They don't know if it's the right orders because it could be a fake. It could be a decoy. So they look at the sort of signature on the bottom as they're bringing them to the general who's going to make a decision for the Union Army. And it just so happens that the sort of assistant outside the general's tent is the one person in the Union Army who can accurately identify the signature because he used to work as a bank teller. And the general in question was someone who was signing checks to go to pay to soldiers back when it was all the American Army. So he had seen the signature hundreds and hundreds of times. So just by complete happenstance, it arrives at exactly the right person who says this is 100% the real signature of the general. And they then act in a way that moves the Union Army quickly. They meet at Antietam. And, you know, it's not some resounding Union victory like Gettysburg is. But it is a moment that really stems the tide of the Confederate sort of, you know, momentum, as it were, and also gives the British government a bit of pause when they are on the fence about joining the war or recognizing the Confederacy, at least. There's a lot of historical debate about the degree to which this was going to happen, but there's some momentum swing. And so, you know, there's this question of what happens if Robert E. Lee catches the Union Army by surprise after a series of victories early on in the Civil War. And they actually win, right? I mean, everything becomes different. And so what I think is particularly useful about counterfactual history and these sort of small moments on which history pivots is that, you know, we think, oh, well, maybe you'd have a different, you know, outcome of the war. I mean, we would have nothing similar. We would have two countries. There would be no Trump. There would be no, I mean, we would have completely different world history. World War II might have unfolded differently if it happened at all. So I think, you know, we like to sort of isolate these counterfactual histories in the moment they exist in, which is who would have won the Civil War. But the world doesn't have categories like this. I mean, everything that followed would have been different, possibly, if the cigars had not been discovered at just the right moment.
Now, there's also, of course, the response to that, which is, yes, Antietam might have come out differently, but eventually the overwhelming industrial might of the North would have prevailed. We would have gotten to the same point eventually. Talk to us a little bit about how you integrate kind of these larger forces and the issue of coming to the same point anyway, whether we diverge, but sort of like in that, you know, movie where they have the two people who are never supposed to meet and they inevitably meet anyway. And they, you know, you can't keep certain forces apart. Tell us how you think about the big forces, which maybe would have determined the course of the war anyway, and these small little events that in the life of a person, in the life of a town, in the life of the family of somebody who didn't die or someone who did die is everything, as your own family history bears out.
Yeah, so I think the best way to answer that is actually with an example from World War I instead of the Civil War. So the start of World War I, as everyone knows, you know, gets triggered by the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo. And one of the things that I think is particularly interesting about this is that the story that most people know is of a fluke of itself, where the car that he's in sputters to a stop right in front of his assassin, and this triggers World War I, right? And the big forces of history have coalesced to this moment, such that the world is at such a moment of sort of fragility that a single assassination can lead to the deaths of millions of people. But the story that most people don't know, which is one of the reasons why I put it in the book, is that 9 or 10 months earlier, the Archduke had been in England on a hunting expedition at a place called Welbeck Abbey. And while he was about to go hunting, the loader for the shotgun slipped in the fresh snow that had fallen on the grounds, and the gun went off, and the bullet sailed about 3 feet over the Archduke's shoulder, almost killed him. Now, I can't say whether World War I would have happened regardless, right, if he had died at Welbeck Abbey. What I can say with certainty is it would have been different, because the trigger event would have been totally different. The timing might have been different. The humiliation of Germany might have been different. All these things matter, right? I mean, the classic example that people use for this is Charles Darwin discovering on the origin of species, because somebody else, a guy named Alfred Russel Wallace, discovered it around the same time. But, you know, I mean, Darwin's cousin was Francis Galton, who was the father of the eugenics movement. And if Darwin hadn't been the person who discovered evolution, would there have been the rise of eugenics and some of the hate-filled racist theories? And so, I mean, every single thing is important. I think these details that we like to tell ourselves can be ironed out, sort of, you know, separated between the signal and the noise. All of the noise matters because the sort of tentacles of history stretch hundreds of years into the future, which is why we're having this conversation after a mass murder took place in 1905.
One of the things I think that disturbs people about the way we talk about politics, and it certainly disturbs me, is there is a complete lack of appreciation for the innumerable events that happen even within a month, let alone a year, let alone 2 years or 3 years. And you have to constantly remind people, we simply don't know how it's going to turn out. It's too soon. There are too many events that need to take place. That does not sit well with people. And I think this goes to your concern about the social sciences. We want certainty. We want to know the outcome. Talk to us a little bit about how that leads us astray and how we can perhaps correct course to account for the fact that we simply don't know in many instances.
Yeah, I think, you know, linking this to modern politics might be useful in the sense of polling and Trump, right? And who's going to win in 2024. So the formal way of thinking about this problem is a term that a lot of people have not heard about, but I think they should, which is called non-stationarity. And it's a complex way of basically saying that cause and effect mechanisms shift over time. So what might be true in one moment is not potentially true in another moment. And the problem is that polls are just a snapshot in the current moment or whenever they were fielded, right? So they're telling you what do people think now, assuming we get the polling right, assuming we have the methodology that's sound, et cetera. They're not telling us what will happen in November. And the problem is that a lot of stuff is going to change. I mean, when you think about, say, you know, March of 2020 to November of 2020, I mean, COVID hadn't really happened at that point. And you have all these people in March of 2024 who are prognosticating, oh, you know, Biden is doomed. It's like, well, we have no idea what's going to happen in the intervening coming months. And the underlying cause and effect mechanisms are subject to change, right? I mean, very big things could happen and likely will happen between now and November. So I think this, like, this impulse that we have, and it's something that also is expected of pundits, right? When we go on TV and we try to explain politics, is to try to give a crystal ball assumption as though the underlying cause and effect dynamics are static, and they're not. And what I think is a problem for the consumer, the sort of news consumer, is that they demand this. And so networks give it to them. And then we end up with this sort of horse race politics that's all about crystal ball, you know, future-oriented imaginations that none of us really know, but we're forced to sort of, you know, pretend we know, instead of talking about the stakes. And I think this is something where Jay Rosen is very good on this, where he talks about the stakes, not the odds. And I think it's important for us to fixate much more on what we can control, which is ensuring that everybody knows why this election matters, and much less on what we can't know, which is who's going to win. And ultimately, you know, the latter actually informs the former, because if you understand why this is so important, you're actually changing the cause and effect dynamics. You might affect the polls because people might understand this is a really dangerous moment in American history.
And when people say, well, we're just saying, what if the election were held today? But it's not today. And that's the point, that there are a million decisions between now and then. You know, if you took this same period of time in 2016, did we know that Comey was going to pop up, you know, 11 days before the election? Did we know that Hillary Clinton wouldn't go to Wisconsin for the right period of time? There is all of this complexity that we kind of wash away by having this kind of crystal ball mentality. What do we learn, or how can we readjust our thinking when we appreciate how little we do know about eventual outcomes? How does that change the way we analyze things, the way we evaluate facts? How does that inform our thinking, or should inform our thinking?
Yeah, this is I think one of the most important arguments I'm trying to make, which is that if you believe the world is certain and you believe it's controllable, which is, I think, the lie that we're often sold in much of modern discourse around politics or social science or AI, machine learning models, et cetera, then you will be hubristic. In other words, you will have overconfidence about how much you can manipulate the world and what you know about the world. If you have a healthy dose of uncertainty and you understand the limits of understanding, you'll be a little bit more careful. And I think that there's a lot of thinking in how politicians operate, in how economies are run, as well as in how we sort of make decisions in our own lives, that imagine that the world is this sort of stationary, static beast that we can control and tame. And I think, you know, to my mind, one of the most important adjustments you can make is just to simply say, we may not know. And I think it's useful to separate out questions we have to answer from questions we don't have to answer. So, for example, you know, a surgeon might not know what is about to be in the person that they're operating on, right? But they still have to make a best guess. They still have to sort of do something to try to treat the patient because they might die otherwise. We do not need to forecast what the inflation rate will be in the United States in 2035. We don't know. It's impossible to forecast, right? It's simultaneously impossible to know who's going to win in 2024. I mean, the polls, I'm not saying we shouldn't do them, but we shouldn't fixate on them so much because we simply can't control the outcome and we can't have a crystal ball. So, you know, I think this focusing on the stuff we can understand about the world, what are the politicians saying about what they're going to do? And I think that is something where, you know, I look at this and I'm using polls to make this argument, so I understand the irony of this, but I look at polls that are about questions related to, have you ever heard of, you know, Biden doing something related to climate change or infrastructure spending, and the number of Americans who have no idea this has happened.
Yes.
I mean, that tells you something about the fact that we've miscalibrated focusing on the stuff we can't know rather than the stuff we already know has happened, right? And I think that the press has an obligation to spend a little bit less time giving the masses sort of the opium of, we know here's what's going to happen, and a little bit more of the sort of, here's what has happened and here's why it matters. And I think that's something where, you know, I'm not blaming the press as some, like, you know, monolithic, you know, idiotic thought machine. It's obviously doing this partly because those stories really take off and there's a huge appetite for people to click on them. But it is something where I think we can recalibrate slightly.
Now, in social science, there's lots of ways in which, as you say, we really, really have to know something. We need to know whether a vaccine is going to work or work better than the alternative. And there are other things that we perhaps don't need to know, or we should be looking at other things. Tell us a little bit about some areas of social science where this appreciation for complexity, for uncertainty, would do us some good.
I love that question. I wish that politicians would listen to this bit, because I think it's a serious problem about how we run our societies. What we basically do when we make policy is we have two teams line up with their best guess of what might work, which is often influenced by ideology. And then one of them wins an election and we try that for 5 years or 4 years or whatever it is, right? Depending on the country. And what I think we should do a lot more of is experimentation, policy experimentation. And this is something where some of the wisdom of social science could actually work for solving problems. So one of my favorite examples of this was in Vancouver in Canada. They had a serious homelessness problem. They still have a serious homelessness problem. But they decided that, you know, all of the sort of heat and rhetoric around this wasn't getting us any closer to knowing what worked. So they tried an experiment where one group got social support, you know, safety net sort of mechanisms through the roof, right? They got loads of counseling, they got temporary housing, they got all the sort of things that the government support would entail. And the other group, randomly selected of homeless people, just got a whole bunch of cash. I think it was like $7,000. And it turned out that the money actually produced much greater outcomes for the people in question. They didn't actually use the money on drugs, as a lot of people thought they might. They actually ended up in housing more permanently on a much greater rate than the other group. And the problem is, any politician who would suggest, let's just give these people some cash, would instantly face annihilation politically until you had evidence that says, hold on, this is way cheaper and it actually solves the problem. Now, I'm not saying this will be universal. It might not work in San Francisco. It might not work in LA, right? But we don't know is the point. We have no idea what works best because we don't test things. We instead simply have voters line up, you know, put someone in charge, and then they take a stab at it with no evidence. And like, if doctors operated that way, so many of us would die, right? It'd be like, right. Well, here's our hunch on how you cure cancer, and we'll have Dr. A versus Dr. B. You know, we systematically evaluate evidence in so much of the rest of the world, and with policymaking, ideology wins out instead. And I think the experimentation approach would be much, much wiser for so many social problems that seem to be intractable.
And you also make the point, I think, that we should use some randomness in how we dole out money as well, because the people who are best positioned to get the money, who are the best grant writers, who are the most connected, there's still a group of people out there that might have a different answer, and we ignore them. Talk to us a little bit about the idea of, kind of, for lack of a better phrase, let 1,000 flowers bloom.
Yeah, so this sort of idea of allocating money for grants, for example, through lotteries, I think it has some lessons that apply to a large area of life, which is when you don't know what to do, experimentation and sometimes randomness is a good idea. So, you know, there's a great study that was done by the Gates Foundation where they looked at the grants they gave out and they compared them to the language that was promised in the grant applications. And what turned out, and this, by the way, had gender bias, the men tended to promise the moon, yes. And the women tended to be more, you know, sort of just sort of to the point about what the research was intended to do. And it turned out that the sort of promises did not actually match up with the outcomes, that there was very little ability to sort of forecast the outcomes of research before you actually did it. Now, this, I think, is something that we all know from the mRNA vaccine, where Katalin Karikó, who was basically almost forced out of her job because no one thought that her research had any value whatsoever, turned out to have identified one of the most important vaccine technologies that has ever existed. And, you know, in the 1990s, she was basically a nobody who was looked down upon by her colleagues. They tried to force her to be bought out of her position and suggested she retire from the academy and so on. And so I think, you know, when you have a baseline where you sort of think, like, this is plausible, anyone's guess is probably the actual way that we should think about these things. We don't know what's going to happen. I mean, a lot of the most important technologies were made by accident. I mean, the microwave was discovered when somebody had a candy bar next to some microwaves and they melted. And they're like, you know, they were trying to make a weapon, I believe, and they actually realized this could cook food. So, you know, it's the kind of stuff where, given how much accidental innovation exists, I think it's wise for us, when we don't know an answer to something, to dial up the degree to which we experiment and use randomness, and dial down the degree to which we sort of hubristically assume we already have all the answers. I think if there's one lesson of the 21st century for politics, it's that we do not understand the world, and we should maybe adjust our thinking accordingly.
One of the points you make that I really love, because it kind of jives with my own personal philosophy, is that the randomness in the world, rather than leading you to a sense of fatalism or powerlessness, should give you a sense of responsibility. Everything matters. You just don't know how it might matter, but who you marry, where you go to school, whether you're nice to the guy on the corner, all that stuff matters. And it may matter as much as, like, really big stuff. Talk to us a little bit about that, and
does that at some point become like paralyzing? Like you don't know if you're making, do I turn right? Do I turn left? Do I tip the guy? Do I not tip the guy? You know, what is civilization going to rise or fall on whether I have the mocha or the latte? Talk to us a little bit about that in your own kind of personal life, how you deal with this.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, it's obviously true to me that everything is important, right? Because the vacation a couple took in 1926 leads to 100,000 people living or dying 19 years later. That is true to smaller and larger degrees for different people. And we have no idea when it's going to be important. Of course, Henry Stimson didn't know his vacation was going to be important either. So, you know, these things, I think, are part of how the universe actually works. And this is why I describe chaos theory and how these sort of small changes can have really big effects. But it's also obviously true that we have all experienced moments where somebody may have made a throwaway comment that was biting, that really affected our thinking and made us feel bad, or the exact opposite, where someone helped us and it turned out to sort of snowball into something greater. And maybe that person was totally unaware of it, right? And of course, when you extrapolate over time, these things get bigger and bigger and bigger. I mean, you have a conversation, you introduce someone to someone, spouses meet, you know, jobs are found, all these things happen. Now, your question about paralysis is a really interesting one, because it is also true, given the fact that the world is sort of interconnected in a very, very bizarre way, that really awful things can produce good outcomes and vice versa. So a mass murder can produce every bit of joy in my life. At the same time, I could also think about planting a tree, and in 100 years, a child falls out of it and dies, and I'll have no way of knowing that, right? But that doesn't mean I shouldn't plant the tree, because we still think probabilistically. So we still think about, on balance, is it better or worse to plant trees? It's the same reason why I still look, even though I believe in flukes and sort of arbitrary aspects of life, I still believe that I should not walk into the road without looking, right? Because maybe I will survive, but probabilistically I might die. So, you know, I think there's some of that that you have to sort of internalize, that a little bit of this in terms of decision-making is a bit of a wash, because you can't forecast the future or know how things are affected. What I think is important philosophically, though, is that a lot of people, and I think there is genuinely an epidemic in modern life of people who feel really low, anxious, depressed, interchangeable, right? I mean, I think a lot of people feel interchangeable because they think that if they were not the cog in the machine of their company, then there would just be somebody else. And I think the point that I'm making here with chaos theory is that the fact that it's you is affecting the future of the world. You don't know how, but the people you produce through having children or the interactions you have, the social relationships, all of those things, for better or worse, are reshaping the future constantly. And the one thing we are not is interchangeable. It's absolutely not true that if it was not me, it would be somebody else and the world would be identical. I think it's scientifically false, but I also think it's really philosophically important to internalize this lesson. And I think so much about the modern world, with models and abstractions away from the detail, they sort of emphasize this idea that we are all just sort of cogs in this vast machine. And I think when you think about your own life, it instantly falls apart. You understand these small moments that you didn't plan have played a huge role. So bizarrely, most of us agree with my argument on our personal life level and totally disagree with it when we think about the rest of the world, which is utterly bizarre how, like, we have all lived this. And then when we start talking about politics, it's all about trends and huge, you know, unstoppable forces, and never about the small stuff.
Right. It's very interesting, because readers ask me all the time, and because they read me, they tend to spend hours immersed in this stuff, and they get very anxious and very depressed. And they say, yeah, but I can't do anything. And what I say to them is, stop reading, start doing. Everything you do is one more push in the right direction. And I think for a society that has become so involved in our phones, in the notion that if you just have enough information, you can make a better decision, that we've taught people to be more passive than they should be. Have you seen this phenomenon? And have you seen how it can change once people start doing things as opposed to worrying about things?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is particularly acute when you come from a sort of European mentality, and Britain maybe less than other places compared to the US. But, you know, there's the lack of protests during the Trump administration, for example. There were some, and some of them quite large. I mean, the women's protests and so on were enormous. But, given the scale of what he was doing, there was a lot of passivity and sort of keyboard warrior mentality of, if we just tweet, it will all be fine.
Right.
And I think, you know, some of this stuff is the feeling of powerlessness in a, you know, a society that has lots of faraway centers of power, whether it's corporate or political, et cetera, and people just feel like they don't matter. But obviously, I mean, when you actually think about that, it's clearly not true. Barack Obama decided to be a community organizer. Right. And, you know, several years later, he was president of the United States in charge of nuclear weapons. I mean, from a personal level, my mom ran for the school board when I was a kid. And it's the main reason why I got interested in politics. And she, you know, it was a small little ripple effect. She thought, okay, I can make the school a little bit better. And then her son gets interested in politics, and I end up writing and becoming a political scientist for a living and so on. I mean, you know, these things shape you know, outcomes big and small. And so one of the things that I often think about in 2024 is that this election is going to largely be decided by who shows up. You know, I think there's a lot of people who've made up their minds. I don't think that persuasion is going to be as strong of a factor in this election as others. I think it's going to be turnout. And so, you know, if each person who is a diehard supporter of democracy, you know, gets five other people to commit to vote, and they do a daisy chain that way, and they each commit to, you know, raising a little bit of money, and they do a daisy chain that way, this is the kind of stuff where it actually adds up to a lot. And I think, you know, especially in swing states, if you live in a swing state, the idea that you are inconsequential, I mean, goodness, that is not true.
Right.
So this is something where I can understand, based on the institutions and the structures, you know, if you live in California, you feel a little bit less powerful. But at the same time, you know, these are the things that shape the future of our democracy. The pipeline of candidates we have at the local level become the national candidates. They become the presidents. So, you know, even the stuff that seems small, as you play it out over time, it all makes a difference. And these ripple effects, I think, are really, really important to keep in mind when we think about how messed up the country has become and how we feel like we're just a small little bit against this sort of behemoth of dysfunction.
I love that. You know, I wrote a book about what the 2016 election, the effect it had on women. And what I found is that a zillion of these little decisions, Abigail Spanberger, who was a CIA agent, decides, I can serve in a different way. You have Mikey Sherrill, a military officer, decides, I can run for office. I know as much of these guys. Six women in Chesterfield County, which is a swing county in Virginia, get together, and then it's 100, and then it's 1,000. And suddenly, they are the biggest political force in a swing county in a major state. And candidates come to get their endorsement, and they fill candidates who had not previously been filled up and down the ballot. So that these small little connective things, the noise, is really what it's about. It's the rest of the stuff that may be noise. What do you think is a good kind of perspective in terms of people's understanding of their ability to change events and a little bit of sense of modesty, of humility? One of the things I got out of this is that the average person should have less humility and the so-called expert should have more humility, that there's an imbalance between the people who think they should have an answer and the people who, yeah, I don't know if I can do anything. Talk to us a little bit about how social scientists should start communicating and convey a level of uncertainty. We get this with polls that they sort of said, well, he's 2 points ahead. Actually, it's a statistical tie and it means nothing because 8 months from now, it's not going to be the same. So talk to us a little bit about how social scientists who apparently live to make policy and live to influence should be more accurately conveying what it is they do and the value of what they do.
Yeah, I'm going to come to that in a second. I just wanted to riff off one of the things you said about the power of individuals, because I think it's so important. Just two quick points. I mean, I went to college with the people who founded Indivisible.
Oh, yes. Which, you know, I know them well.
They, you know, they just decided to do something. They've got now this massive grassroots network.
Yes.
But for other people, you know, the school board may seem like small fry, and it's not just my, you know, my personal impact that I had from my mom running for it. But the books that are banned at the local level affect the minds of the people that then, you know, are going to become the future leaders of the country, whether they are open-minded or not. I mean, all these locuses of power really do matter. And I think it's incredibly, incredibly wrong to believe that each person can play no role. On the point about uncertainty and conveying it, I think there's a lot of things that is misunderstood both about social science and about polling. I mean, social science is a level of uncertainty that I think is much, much greater than the average person realizes. I think that there are studies that contradict each other that are passed off as fact, and I think ideology enters the picture a huge amount of the time, especially in political science, with contentious studies. I'm not saying about the researchers, I'm saying about the ways that people interact with the studies, although occasionally there are sort of research malpractice things that happen. But more to the point with polls, I mean, I think the average person does not understand all of the different ways that polls can be slightly out of whack, right? And I think it's really important for people to understand that. So first off, you have the margin of error. That is a huge problem because sometimes the margin of error changes who's in the lead, right? And that's yes. that's sort of put in the small print of, you know, if the margin of error is actually there, if it's plus or minus 4 points, I mean, that's a swing of 8 points for
yes.
one
and
of
by the
candidates.
Way, people yeah. have to realize the plus or minus four is each number.
Exactly.
So someone who's 4 points ahead could really be 8 points behind.
Exactly. And this is the kind of thing where, you know, if you have a 50-50, you know, you could easily have a 46-54. That would be the way of thinking about it, is that there's a huge divergence that can happen. Now, I also would say that one of the things that pollsters are struggling with right now is figuring out, A, who the electorate is. They don't know who's going to vote in November. And B, getting those people on the phone to answer questions or in online surveys, however they access them. And one of the things that I use in my own teaching is I have, the New York Times actually does this really admirably when they release polling data, especially at the congressional level. They do something that very few pollsters do. They have listed how many people they tried to call. And I haven't seen this on everyone, but on some of the reporting, they show this. And in some of them, it's like 40,000 calls for 500 respondents. Right? Now, when you think about that, if there's even a slight bias in who's picking up the phone, now, of course, they're trying to correct this. They're not stupid people. They're trying to figure this out. But if there's even a slight bias in the kinds of people who are likely to answer the phone, even in the demographics, right? I mean, somebody who's 18 to 30 years old who gets a random phone call that happens to be a hyper-connected urbanite might hit ignore, whereas someone who lives, you know, in an environment that's got a lot less connectivity and is less likely to be cold contacted might pick up, right? And these little biases can manifest in skews, especially when you look at crosstabs, which is basically the subdivision of polling by demographic groups, which sometimes are really small. I mean, you might have 5 people in the 18 to 30 demographic who are Democrats, and then you have a story written about this group. You know, I'm not saying this is universal. A lot of pollsters are very careful about this, but it's something where there's uncertainties that just abound everywhere. And, you know, the way it's translated is Biden is up in the polls, Biden is down in the polls. And that's it, right? That's the headline. And so I think, you know, the way I describe this when I talk about polling is I have absolutely no idea who's going to win in 2024. I know that there are things that you can do to make it more likely that the candidate that you want to win will win. And I think there's information that people like us in the media have that if we convey it more aggressively, that people will start to pay attention more to the stakes of the election. So, you know, I think there's some of this stuff where it's, you know, I'm fighting against a huge
yes.
media culture that gets a lot of money off of the sort of horse race coverage. And I understand
yes.
that, but it is, I think, to our detriment if we consume that all the time.
And this is one of the reasons I love the book, by the way, because I spend hours agonizing over this and trying to explain that, no, he didn't race from behind. He was never behind to begin with. Stop that. Or he's currently behind. Does he have time to catch up? No, there's no catching up. You know, it's not. That's wrong. That's just wrong. One of the things you talk about is the way researchers kind of select themselves. In teaching, we call it teaching to the test. There's a certain bias in research about figuring out, gosh, did I come up with something that I must be wrong because I'm way out of the norm here. And the way out of the norm may have discovered something that's critical. Talk to us a little bit about kind of the social science inquiry process and how they can both trust in the results, but also accept that something that's an outlier maybe really isn't an outlier. Talk to us a little bit about that for them.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things that happen. One is that you have a certain kind of person gravitates towards a certain kind of research. So that's a hidden form of bias, right? It's people who really care about certain issues or topics are more likely to research them. And sometimes they have personal skin in the game. Of course, we're trained to be as unbiased as possible, but sometimes it manifests itself. I think the bigger issue, and this is one that I wrote about in the book, and I want this to get so much more attention because I think it warrants a reckoning in social science, is there was a study called the Universe of Uncertainty Study, which very few people have picked up on. And I think it's really disturbing what it found. So basically what they did was they took 76 research teams, totally unbiased, people who are just trying to get the right answers. They gave them the exact same data, right? So all the numbers are the same, all the data is the same. And they said, we want to figure out whether it is the case that having more immigration makes people more or less likely to support social safety nets, right? It's a pretty important question for policymaking. It's a question for public attitudes, et cetera. And the thing that was crazy about this was that when they actually ran this study with these 76 research teams, roughly speaking, about a quarter of the research teams found that it made people less likely to support safety nets. About a quarter of the research teams found it made them more likely to support safety nets. And about half the research teams found that there was no effect. And it's a bell curve. I mean, this is crazy, right? Because yep. These people were trying to answer the question in good faith, and they got basically a random distribution of answers, depending on the methodologies they choose, all of which were respectable and well-intentioned and so on. And of course, what actually happens in social research is one research team picks its data that it wants to use, picks its methodology, and then the reporting is, here's what the study found. And we never had the 76 research teams, right? We just had the one. So like, you know, the problem also is that you can never really debunk a lot of social research when it becomes contentious. So you have this question, you know, does cutting taxes increase growth? This question has been around for a very long time. It is a massive debate in right and left circles. And we still don't have a definitive answer to it. I mean, most researchers will say that, yes, it's probably the case that there's a little bit of an effect at first, but actually a lot of the trickle-down effects that were hypothesized were overstated, right? Significantly overstated, and it wasn't actually good for the economy. It just increased inequality. But it's like a zombie research question. It just lingers on forever because, you know, unlike with physics, where if the experiment is off by a trillionth of a decimal point in physics, the theory is wrong. If you are able to explain 60% of the variation in the data in social science, it's one of the best theories that exists. And this is the problem, right? You can't falsify something when it mostly matches the data. And that's what social science is. So that's a fundamental problem that I don't think will ever be solved because humans are really, really complicated. But it means that we have to speak about our findings with the sort of careful uncertainty that I think the actual evidence warrants.
And it is interesting. In that study, they were given the same data set, that it wasn't like they had different parts of the data and you can come to different conclusions. They had the exact same information. And that also rarely happens out there because you want to find out if raising the minimum wage causes more unemployment. So you go to a town in Pennsylvania and somebody else goes to a town someplace else. And the complexities are such that you'll never really be able to isolate that one little factor. And so you come up with these kind of random, you know, examples. When you are talking to students, and you tell them this, it may be a bit disillusioning because they're saying, I'm paying for this education and I'm not going to know anything about anything. What do you tell students to kind of give them a sense that in spite of all this, it's important to figure things out? It's important to look at the human condition. What do you tell them?
Yeah, I love that. I've never been asked that question, but I actually do have a little spiel I talk to, because I teach a social research class. Yeah. And I basically say, look, I'm going to really make you question all the things you've been taught in all your other classes when you think about this stuff. But I think, you know, the answer is that social research is the only tool we have to try to avoid catastrophic problems, which is what I ultimately think this is for, right? Like the reason we do this is because the world is shaped by our decisions. And having better information about the world is going to allow us in ideal situations, to avoid catastrophic mistakes. Now, of course, we still follow stupid politicians sometimes, and we say, you know, self-inflicted errors, even with good information, are going to happen. But I think, you know, there are better or worse ways of understanding the world. And one of the things that I think is important is not to sweep under the rug the sort of rough spots of social research or the uncertainty about prognostication in politics. I think when you do that, you give people this false sense of certainty, which leads to that hubris I talked about. And it also leads to misunderstanding the world, which creates catastrophic, you know, miscalculations and mistakes. So I think, you know, when you give students the sort of idea, look, there are problems with how we understand the world, you can be part of the solution. You know, you go and do a PhD, you have to critique this stuff, what's been said before. You know, I think I look back at my PhD research, and I think a lot of the quantitative methods are pretty flawed because it was a different era, right? It was different tools, different assumptions, different methods. And I think, you know, to the point you were saying before about how you actually do this stuff, one of the reasons why the data is sometimes, you know, so skewed in certain ways, even when you use the same data, is because when you try to figure out whether people support the social safety net, you usually don't use that word, right? Because that means a million different things to different people. So you might ask them, do you support welfare payments? Okay, that sounds very different to, do you support giving people support when they feel down on their luck, right? So the way you word questions radically affects the answers you get. And so this is the problem. It's a moving target. You know, if you prime people by saying, are you a supporter of Trump? And then you ask them a different question, their responses are different. So, you know, if you say, are you a supporter of Trump? And then you go to, what do you think about immigration? They're more likely to be anti-immigrant in the second question. So I think this is the problem that we have both with polling and social research, is that there is probably somewhat of an underlying view that we're trying to figure out, but it's very malleable, right? I mean, that's the other thing that happens in politics, is like, one of my favorite charts of all time is looking at attitudes towards the NFL among Trump supporters and Clinton supporters. And the lines completely switch when Trump calls out the NFL for having its black players sitting on the sideline, kneeling on the sidelines during the Black Lives Matter movement. And all of a sudden, these people who have been watching the NFL as diehard fans for their entire lives say the NFL is evil, right? In the span of one tweet, basically.
Yes.
So then what's, you know, how strong is that attachment? We don't know. Do you now hate the NFL even though you've loved it for your whole life? Well, in the poll, the answer is yes. So I think this is the kind of stuff where the motivated reasoning that people have around politics makes it really difficult to adequately measure what they actually think. And that, you know, gums things up even further.
Wow. So do you have a second book in the works? What comes after this? This seems to be like, you know, the magnum opus. What's coming next?
I appreciate that. I don't know yet. There will be another one, but it's, you know, it's one of the things that when you write books, as you know, you're always sort of looking for something that you want to devote enough time to. I mean, it's sort of, you know, do I really want to spend 2 years of my life on this idea I had over coffee?
Yes.
And often the book sort of fizzles out after that when you have the deep thought that this might not be worth 2 years of my life. So I don't know yet, but I'll be on the lookout for good topics to dive into.
That's great. What's been the reaction to the book? Are people resistant, or do they kind of appreciate a level of honesty, frankly, that they don't get from a lot of what they read, a lot of what they hear from so-called experts?
Well, I've been really happy with the response. I mean, I think a lot of people have found the book's resonated or spoken to something in their life that they didn't know how to describe in a sort of systematic way, to think about these sort of arbitrary accidental forces that have affected their own lives. I mean, some people hate it, right? I mean, that's, and that to me is the mark of a book that is trying to provoke someone to think differently. You know, I'm sort of glad that not everyone thinks it's okay. It's sort of that would be the mark of a book that sort of just coddled people. But I also think that there is some degree to which people resist the overwhelming nature of the idea that everything matters. I think that,
yes.
I fully admit this is something that bewilders me. It bothers me sometimes to think about it. I think it's scientifically true. And I think the lack of control also is something that bothers people. I would rather live in a world that is honestly understood, or more honestly understood, than one that has comforting lies and is riskier. And I think, you know, I'm not trying to sort of paint with one broad brush, but I think a lot of the ways that we're taught about the world, whether it's through the news or politics or models or whatever it is, there's much neater and tidier stories that we use to make sense of the world we inhabit. And my argument is, it's bewildering, but we should embrace the complexity and the uncertainty, because it's much more important to be accurate than to be comforted.
So in other words, this is the truth and you can handle it.
Exactly. Well put. Exactly. That's exactly right.
Well, I think we'll end on that note. Ryan, thank you so much. I cannot recommend the book enough. It is fascinating. It's confounding. It's a book that sticks with you for days and weeks after as you kind of think through it and you see little events in your life. So thank you for the book and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
And that was Brian Klass. Wow. I told you, it is really fascinating stuff. It really makes you stop and think. And I think it comes back to something that I have told you folks over and over again about polling: less obsession, less mischaracterization, less certainty that these people know what they're talking about, and focusing on what you can do and what the election is about. It sounds simplistic, but it's really not. And in the bigger scheme of things, this is what democracy is about. It's about you matter. That's what democracy is: individuality, individual effort. Do you vote? Do you help other people to vote? Do you give money and time to causes that matter? And how do you communicate with people? Do you speak up when someone says something that is homophobic or racist or anti-Semitic? Do you offer to explain something to someone who maybe says something that is not out of malice, but simply out of ignorance? All those little actions are really what it's all about. And to be honest, it's all we can do. If you have a big network, great, use it. I try to use it as best as I can. And if you have a small network of people, use that, because it's all pushing in the right way. And I think the point about getting people to understand more and more matters. There's a terrible cynicism in the election coverage. Remember the whole phrase, nothing matters? Of course it matters. Of course it matters. The cumulative weight of evidence does matter. The further degeneration of Trump mentally, emotionally, morally matters. The overwhelming evidence of an economy on the upswing matters. The sheer decency and demonstrated kindness of the president and vice president matter, and you matter. So get the book. It's a great read. There's a whole section at the end we didn't have a time to talk about, which is all about free will, which gets very woo-woo, very religiously and philosophically fascinating. But I think you'll enjoy the whole thing. So thank you for joining me. If you enjoyed this program and you enjoyed our other programs, please tell your friends. They can listen and follow on Spotify, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, or wherever they get their podcasts. Bye-bye.